Well, good morning, church. It is great to see you all. As always, it's great to be together. I'm so thankful for the Forest Mill Church and for what we mean to one another, for what we mean to our community, and for what the Lord is doing in us and through us today. I'm excited about what the future holds. I'm looking forward to Easter Sunday, spending that with you all, to Baby Dedication Sunday, Mother's Day. There's so many great things going on in Forest Mill. I hope that you will know that you are important to being a part of that with us. We've been studying through the Gospel of Mark now for a few weeks. And remember, I wanted to do a real quick reminder here up front that Mark is writing to Christians who are undergoing some pretty severe persecution. And by persecution, we mean that they're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, they're losing their families. Some of them are even losing their lives, all because, for the sole reason, that they are following Jesus. So it's only natural at some point for maybe some of them to start to question, to wonder, is it really even worth it? I mean, if following Jesus means I'm going to lose everything, is following this Jesus worth it? So Mark is trying to convince these struggling Christians, and in order to do that, he reminds them about who Jesus is. That's really what the first part of the Gospel of Mark is about, telling who Jesus is, that Jesus' words have powers, right? He talked or have power, that he spoke in parables, and some people got it, some people didn't, but that Jesus' words have power, that his teachings change the world, and that Jesus is more than even these Christians could imagine. So Mark tells them some pretty strange, some bizarre stories that at the time they're happening, even Jesus' closest followers, like the apostles, his best friends, and his people who were living with him day in and day out, the ones who were there, that even they sit up and ask this question, who is this? Right? They look at Jesus after what Jesus has said, after what Jesus has done, and they're like, who is this? And that's what's just happened at the end of chapter 4 that we got through last week. It was the story of Jesus calming the storm. Remember, Jesus was sleeping in this small boat as they were crossing the Sea of Galilee at night. The storm gets wild. His disciples wake him up in fear, and there's water like lapping over the sides. It's spilling over the sides. It's just ponded there in the bottom of the boat. The wind is howling. The waves are whipping, and they are afraid for their lives. And then with just a word, Jesus speaks, and the storm dissipates. The water's still, and the wind dies. And sort of just leaves his disciples there with their eyes bulging and their jaws on the floor of the boat. And they're asking themselves, who is this that even the wind and the seas obey him? So this next story that we have here at the beginning of Mark chapter 5, it's sort of like an answer to that question. Who is this? And Mark shares this really odd story. And it all starts when Jesus changes another unchangeable situation. He conquers something that's unconquerable. And it's at the end of their boat ride. They make it to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and they land in this region on the other side that's a Gentile region. This is not a Jewish region. There's a lot of things that could point you to that. This is not a Jewish region. He's trying to get away from the press of the crowds who are Jewish crowds following him because they're looking for a Messiah. Jesus is, they think, maybe a Messiah. He's certainly a miracle worker and a powerful teacher. Jesus goes somewhere nobody knows him, on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And this is how it unfolds. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and he broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Pause right there. What a menace. I mean, can you imagine having this guy as your next door neighbor? I mean, you think the people who collect junk are bad. I mean, this is wild right here. This guy's running around, he's yelling, I mean he's cutting himself so he's bloody, he's tearing chains apart, he's breaking these leg shackles, which I just went down a little bit of a deep dive. They found these are ancient Roman leg shackles, and these date back, they don't go quite back to the time of Jesus. These go back to about 200 to 400, somewhere in there, but the technology didn't change much. These were just iron leg shackles that were sometimes put on slaves. They were certainly put on people who they considered dangerous. And this guy is tearing chains apart, like iron chains, tearing those apart, and he's breaking the unrusted version of these. So it's no wonder that this guy is living out here among the tombs. The tombs don't mean like a graveyard. Remember, their tombs were built on the side of cliffs, so they're caves. That's where they would take their dead. You don't dig a hole in rock, right? So you don't bury someone in rock. You place them in a cave. So he's living in the cave because that's the only place he could get shelter. You don't want him living in your town. He couldn't go back. So this was the only place he could find shelter after he was driven out of town, living literally among the dead. So when he saw Jesus at a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. And he shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." So, pause again, because this is not the way I think about Jesus' miracles working. Jesus already told the impure spirit to come out. Boom, supposed to be happening right now. It has not happened yet. So whatever is going on here, sometimes maybe Jesus' miracles take a little longer than my instantaneous modern brain thinks. Jesus speaks, and the demon is still there, saying, "Don't torture me." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send him out of the area. Now, again, another pause. Have you ever noticed the deal with names here? Isn't it a little odd? Like, he comes up and he's calling out Jesus by not just the name Jesus or Jesus of Nazareth or Messiah or any of the titles we might immediately think of, Son of Man. I mean, he comes in with a very specific name, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. Now, this is an identity that even Jesus' closest followers, his apostles, have not dared call him this yet. They don't even know this yet. And this demon comes to him proclaiming this name, and then Jesus turns around and he asks this demon for his name. What is going on with names? Well, have you ever heard the old, I remember I had it in a book when I was a kid, Grimm's Fairy Tales, the story of Rumpelstiltskin. You remember that story? Yeah, it's a great movie, obviously very child-friendly. And you would think, right? But fairy tales were rarely child-friendly. So in this old fairy tale, long story, the Miller's daughter, who later becomes queen, she has to give this imp her firstborn child because he saved her from a bad situation. So in order to save her child, she sort of strikes a bargain, and he says, "I will release you if you learn my true name. If you learn my true name." Well, this old fairy tale is pulling from a much, much, much older belief that knowing someone's true name grants you power over them. Maybe you've even heard that before. That if you know someone's true name, you have some way, some measure of power over them. This was certainly a persistent belief in Jesus' day. So maybe these demons come running out in the body of this man. They're calling out Jesus' true name in the hopes that they might be able to save themselves. If I say Jesus' real name, I can compel him to do what I want, which is to not kill me, right? But Jesus is having none of it. And then Jesus asked the demon his name. So you're thinking, aha, this is how Jesus is going to gain control over the demon. He's going to learn the demon's true name. But the demon just says, no, my name is Legion, which is not a real name. It's literally the name of a Roman unit in an army that was about 6,000 soldiers. This does not mean there's 6,000 demons. Now, this is not about a numerical count like the demons, you know, numbered off one, two, and they got all the way up to 6,000 and hopped in this guy's body. Now, legion just connotes that they are like an army-like force working in concert to control this man. They are many of them working together on this guy. So Jesus doesn't even get a demon's real name. This is just the name they call the group. But even when Jesus doesn't have his real name, and he does have Jesus' real name, it's clear who is in control of this situation. Right? Jesus is the one who's in control of this situation here. So continue on. It says, a large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, send us among the pigs and allow us to go into them. And he gave them permission. Again, Jesus is given permission. He's in control, right? And the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. And the herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. And that's the miracle. That's the miracle story. Demonstrating Jesus' power and mastery over this incredibly powerful horde of demons. And it's the main point you might take from this is that even opposing spiritual forces cannot oppose Jesus. That they are powerless before Jesus of Nazareth. That there is no other God or force or power or spiritual power that's out there that can stand before the power of Jesus. And that certainly would have been a lesson that would persecuted Christians would have appreciated, because all of their friends and family and community and area, they all worshiped different gods. So you might start thinking, all this bad stuff's happening to me, maybe it's because my God is weaker than their God. But he's saying, no, Jesus is Son of the Most High God, the Most High God, and he controls these other spiritual powers like nothing, right? He is ruling over these powers. And so Jesus is in control, and God is in control, even though you can't see it, and it doesn't feel like it because of your circumstances, God is still in control. So that's a really important lesson for persecuted Christians to understand. But for some weird reason, that's not where Mark ends the story. Instead, we get this rare sort of follow-up account where we see the reactions, not just of this man, but of the villagers, the people who live nearby. And this is what's really fascinating to me, because it says when they came to Jesus, these villagers, by the way, the shepherds, or I don't know what you call pig herders, just, you know, the pig farmers, they run, they tell everybody in town, all these folks come, and they come to Jesus, and they see the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed. So this obviously was a new state of affairs for this man. He's now dressed, and he's in his right mind. And they were afraid. And so those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man, and they talked about the pigs as well. And then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave the region. That's weird, isn't it? You know, some people don't like this story. Some people don't. Mark does not tell us why, but we could probably guess. Some people today might not like it because one man's life is saved at the expense of 2,000 cute and adorable pigs. Maybe that's why some people don't like it, because all of these awesome, you know, full of life, intelligent pigs are killed. That's not fair. You saved one guy's life, it cost 2,000 pigs, right? Some people may not like it because this would have been an extraordinary loss of income for the farmer. Whoever owned those pigs, whether it was one guy or families of people, whatever, whoever owned those pigs, this was a large herd of pigs, even by Gentile standards. This would have been a big one. And so maybe that's why the villagers didn't like it. They were like, oh my goodness, you've cost our village our income for this year. So some people don't like it because of that. Or maybe they didn't like it because Jesus saved someone they didn't want at the cost of the pigs that they did. There's another way of looking at this story. There's a way of looking at it where the value of those pigs' lives is more valuable than the life of a human being. Where saving the life of these animals is more important than delivering the life of a human being. There's also a way of looking at it where my profits, my profit margin, is more important than another person's salvation. But that's not the way of Jesus. And I'm going to tell you, it breaks my heart, but there are a lot of people who claim the name Christian who tell you today that that's not the case, that you should care more about your profits than another person's life. But that's not the way of Jesus. The prophet Isaiah, hundreds of years earlier, he talks about it this way. I love this passage from Isaiah chapter 65, and I sort of condensed some of it down, but this is God speaking here. He said, I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me, right? I was found by those who did not even seek me. To a nation that did not call on my name, I said, here am I. So he's talking about nations that are not his people, right? Foreign nations, Gentile people. He's like, I'm revealing myself to these people who aren't even looking for me or asking for me. All day long, I've held out my hands to an obstinate people, right? A hard-headed people. And then he describes them. And one of the ways he describes them is those who sit among the graves and who spend their nights keeping secret vigil, who eat the flesh of pigs and whose pots hold broth of impure meat, who say, keep away, don't come near me, for I'm too scared of you. Jesus comes to a Gentile region, to people who have no idea who he is. They're not looking for him. They don't even know what a Messiah is. And Jesus comes to those people, and in the strongest way possible, he demonstrates his power to free them to deliver them from these spiritual oppressing forces. And in turn, for Jesus showing them who he was and what he could do, they're like, we want nothing to do with you. Just like these people in Isaiah. And here's the really crazy thing. Jesus sends the man who was formerly demon-possessed, it's a new disciple. He wants to follow Jesus, even asks if he can go back. But you talk about raising eyebrows. If Jesus had come back to Judea with a Gentile follower who had been demon-possessed, that might have been a distraction for a lot of the people trying to listen to the message. And so Jesus knows better than that. It's like, you can do me more good here. So Jesus sends this new disciple, this formerly demon-possessed Gentile, to go spread the news to the folks who are there, right? He said, you go back to your home. Because suddenly, this man is no longer the one who's unwanted. Jesus is. Jesus took on this man's unwanted status on himself. Jesus became the pariah to save the pariah. All of a sudden, they're not interested in getting rid of this formerly demon-possessed man. They don't want Jesus. Jesus takes on that unwantedness from this man. And when he does that, it changes all of the dynamics. Because Jesus is in the business of saving unwanted people. Jesus is in the business of redeeming unwanted lives. And if that is the case, if Jesus saves unwanted people, if Jesus redeems unwanted lives, then you and I this morning, we've got one question that we have to ask before we close this lesson. The one question we have to ask is, who are the unwanted in our world today? Who are the unwanted? Maybe it's people whose gender is a little more fluid than we care to see, whose sexuality is way out there, whose morals or criminal history or country of origin or voting ideas are way different than mine. And no matter how messed up you think those people are, I promise you, they're not as messed up as this guy. They're not inhabited by an army of opposing demons. And if Jesus could redeem someone that opposed to him, whose life was that contrary to him, who was literally living among the dead, if Jesus could save those living among the dead, he can save those people. And we have to ask ourselves, how do we redeem lives that broken? Because there is no one, no matter how far flung you imagine them to be, there is no one beyond the reach of this Jesus. There is no one's lifestyle, no one's voting choices, no one's country of origin, no one's history, no one's present, no one's future, no one who is beyond redemption by this Jesus. Can I get an amen? By the way, we are now an amening church. I meant to tell you that at the first. We are now an amening church because there is no one beyond the reach of this Jesus. And no one's trying to say, well, just leave the demon-possessed man alone. He's fine like he is. Nobody's saying that. Nobody's condoning that this guy was breaking chains and running around naked and cutting himself. No one's condoning his lifestyle or his actions, but neither are they turning away. If Jesus can redeem those lives, whose lives can we redeem even if it costs us everything? If they become accepted and we don't. So no matter who they are, no matter how broken they are, no matter how far they seem from Jesus, it can't be any further than this guy. And you know, I'm just going to close with this. Because when Mark or any of the other New Testament authors, they wrote in Greek. They didn't write in English, like King James tells us. They wrote in Greek. And so if they wanted to remember an Old Testament scripture, they wanted to quote it and tell us an Old Testament scripture, they're not quoting English, and they're not even quoting Hebrew. Most of the time, they're quoting from a version of the Old Testament called the Septuagint, or the LXX, which was basically just the Old Testament translated to Greek. And this is important. This is important because as Mark is telling us this story about Jesus, he has to be thinking about this passage from Psalm 68, because this is the way that psalm is written in Greek. He said, God settles the solitary in a house, leading forth prisoners mightily, also them that act provokingly, even them that dwell in the tombs. This morning, I want my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is that we might be a people who, following in the footsteps of Jesus, lead forth prisoners from the dead, just the way our Jesus did. That we will learn to see and love people no matter how far from Jesus they may be, because their lives are redeemable, and that makes a powerful testimony before the Lord. This morning, if we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up, you are not too far from Jesus. Your life can be redeemed. And if we can help you with that this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?